Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Live from captivity, this is Hollywood and Levine. I'm your sequestered host, Ken Levine, and this week and next, oh man, I got a treat for you. This is a great, great guest. Rob Long is with me this week and next. Now, Rob started out as a writer by getting on staff of Cheers. He since has gone on to have a very long and distinguished career. And instead of an interview, this really is more like two veteran writers just sitting around telling war stories, offering advice. It's a fascinating two-parter that starts this week. Rob Long, part one on Hollywood and Levine.
Well, you talk about baby writers, which is the expression when new writers join a staff. But when I first met you and your partner, Dan Staley, on Cheers, you were baby writers, almost literally. You guys were like almost still teenagers when you broke in. Take us back to how you guys managed to break in so quickly and so high to break in on Cheers. Wow.
It was very strange. Look, everything has changed. Look, I have to set it up by saying this all happened during the George H.W. Bush administration. So when you say so young baby writers, I just feel like one of those infantrymen in World War I, and they're looking at the camera as they go over the thing and they're about to die. It was a different time. So I was 24, which at the time was young, but not as crazy young as it seems today when 24-year-olds are still living with mom and dad in the basement and wondering what they're going to do and like getting interested in creative stuff and whatever. 24-year-olds now are doing TikToks. Like, that's not what I had a job. I had to work, right? So Dan, my partner, was in New York, and he was an advertising copywriter, actually an award-winning advertising copywriter. He was basically Don Draper, right? And he could have stayed there and been Don Draper, but instead he wanted to go. And so we wrote a couple of specs, and somebody told me, here's what you do. You send them to, you watch TV, and the shows you like, you write down their names, and then you call the Writers Guild. You had a call, and you find out who their agents are. You got three, you could ask for three writers' agents per call, and you had to hang up and call back the same lady, but you had to just do that. And then you write those agents because they're representing writers on shows you like. And so it turned out that all the shows I liked were Cheers and other shows that were represented by the same agency. And the junior writers, I called up for Ken Levine and David Isaacs, and I got a name that kept reappearing, but I sensed that that name was probably a little too high. And then I found some younger writers who were also at that agency with a new agent, not a named agent at the time. And I just wrote her a letter and sent her the specs. And then she started screaming at me on the phone about a month later when I called to ask her if she'd read them, to tell me how hard it is to build a spec house in Ventura, which is true. She just picked up the phone. I'm talking to her assistant and said, I'm trying to build a spec house in Ventura. It's very difficult. And I'm like, okay, all right. And then she signed us 2 weeks later. And she then, because she was aggressive, she was a good agent. She called up. So that was the Broder, Curlin, Webb, Uffner agency. And they represented a couple of writers, a couple of no names you might have heard of, Ken Levine, David Isaacs. And everybody else on Cheers. And she knew there's always staff writer money in every budget. That's like basically zero. It's not a lot, but it's there. And she kind of convinced the showrunners at the time that they needed to fill that spot with us. I don't think they were looking. I don't think they knew. Knowing the guys running, Bill Steinkellner, Sherry Eich, and Afif Sutton, they were just busy like making funny TV shows. They weren't, you know, they were just doing it. And they said, okay, well, I guess we'll meet these guys. I don't care. No, you're fine. And then we just went in for a meeting and we weren't crazy. And they said, okay, we'll give you 10 weeks. And we started with 10 weeks. And Bill Steinkellner gave me very, very good advice, which is he just said, keep it shut, which was very good advice for a young writer.
You know, it's very true, because young writers will join the staff and they'll feel they need mm-hmm. to contribute every yeah. minute yeah, right. when really it's sort of understood that you're new. Yeah. Just absorb what's right. going on. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, keep it shut. So, and that's kind of how it started. And it's also at that point, no one, it seems so simple now. And I think it actually is kind of still simple. People have made it more complicated, but it wasn't like people in, you know, you go to a college now, everybody's got a spec. They're all writing specs. Nobody knew what a spec was when I was in college. Nobody knew how to break into the TV business. I had to be in LA going to film school to learn how to do that. So, you know, in a lot of ways, it was just the right place, right time, right kind of like, you know, we just kind of Forrest Gumped our way into it. I'm not convinced now that you can't do that. I think there's a lot too much career strategizing among some younger writers, and not enough just sitting down and writing specs. But that's kind of how it was. And then we just sat there, and then, you know, it was Cheers. So it was like, you know, the show ran itself, or like it had its own voice. Our job was just to not run out of ideas and energy.
Well, a lot of times baby writers will come in and, like I said, either they will try to really make themselves known, which is a bad idea, or they come in and they are deer caught in headlights. And and you and Dan, from day one, that's really the first time I met you was when you guys
I think it was literally day one. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that you guys seemed so poised. Were you terribly intimidated? Because if you were, you did a very good job of not showing it.
I think we were just too busy. Well, we were just too busy trying to figure it out all out, you know, like just, okay, this is how this happens. This is how this happens. And I think Dan was in his own kind of space because he had just come from, you know, a big creative industry that has a certain process to it. And he was trying to figure out how this is alike and not alike what he just come from. I mean, literally just come from like 2 weeks before. And for I think one of the other writers asked us that. Said, you guys didn't seem nervous. Were you nervous? Oh, yeah, I'm nervous. Like, we didn't seem nervous. That's because we weren't fans of the show.
How many episodes did you write for Cheers? You wrote quite a few.
Yeah, we wrote a bunch. But the thing is, when you're in that, you know how it is, and you're in that zone and you're that level, it's like you're not that important that you can, we need you here to write, to do the rewrites, right? We have like the best comedy writing talent around is coming in to help us with the rewrites. We have Levine and Isaacs, David Lloyd, Bob Ellison, we're okay. We need somebody to go away for 2 weeks and take this kind of weird, very, very slapdash idea and outline that we kind of didn't do a great job pitching out because we got a million things to do. And they go away for 2 weeks and they come back and they've turned it into a draft. And I remember just the first time we did that, the draft came back and it was terrible. And they're like, oh, this is not working. And then they gave us notes for a second draft. And then we went away and did a second draft and felt like we had like, oh my God, we're going to get fired. And then we brought back the second draft and they're like, this is exactly what we want. Yes. Wonderful. And I remember being taken in to, I think, Sherry's office, and she just closed the door. She said, it's wonderful. And I thought, okay, now I get it. Like We blew it. Nobody panicked. They gave us notes. All the notes were instructive. Okay, here's why the thing you did is moronic. Like, you cannot have this happen. And then we just changed it. And then we never had that problem again. I mean, it's really, I actually feel like, I don't know, I sound like an old man now, but I actually feel like that is a huge problem now in TV business, is that nobody does second drafts. Young writers don't learn anything. Like, there's never that teaching moment, which I thought was like, I mean, that was much more important to our career and our career success than me sending our specs to the right agent. It was just that moment, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've always observed that you put a staff together for your show and you give every staff member a script assignment.
Yeah.
And then the scripts come back and they always look like episodes of the last series they worked on. Okay. If the guy had just been on Mad About You and you get the script back, and it's a Mad About You script with your characters. And if somebody worked on a Whit Thomas show, it had that feel to it. And it does take some time to lock in to the rhythm of that particular show. And once you do, and again, as a showrunner yourself, you know how incredibly valuable it is that you have writers who can give you drafts that are serviceable, that it only takes a day to polish and put on the stage.
Yeah, that's one of those things where it's like, it's a very strange thing, I think, if you're the writer, to be told, you are so valuable, we want you to stay out of the office for the next year. I want to see you once every 3 weeks to come in and get another draft and go away. But actually, that is the script factory. That's where you learn a whole lot. And also, I feel like there are, it doesn't usually happen the first one. It didn't happen with us. And, you know, when you get handy with it, you start to anticipate problems and solve them. That problems that were insurmountable, really, basically, when the story was pitched by your bosses. And the last thing you want to hear when you're the showrunner and you got a busy day is, you know, I don't know if the D scene that you pitched out is, and if solve it, for God's sake, you fix it. What am I? Like, I'm not going to... I don't know if we really, like, I'm done. I spent 3 hours with you on this. Now you go. And then when you don't get those calls and it comes back and it's great, so I think sometimes it's disappointing for young writers because that it's if it's good, I don't notice that you fixed all the bad stuff that I pitched. Sometimes I remember one time I was doing a show and a writer came back and had, a couple of four or five jokes that he didn't put in that I had pitched and an elaborate explanation why he didn't put them in. And I could only assume that this was like this incredibly subtle, passive aggressive act on his part to show me tell me, A, I listened to all the jokes you pitched. B, here are five terrible ones that you pitched. And I'm going to tell you why they didn't fit and use story logic reasons. But you and I both know it's because they suck. And I don't think he was really doing that. But that was the message I received was like, okay, he's sitting at home and saying, that bastard, he just pitched this dumb joke off the top of his head. And everybody laughed because they all worked for him. And now I got to put it in the script. And he kind of, which to me, I applauded that. That's that guy. I think he's running his own show now. I mean, that's exactly right. That's where you
first time David and I got an assignment at MTM, the Tony Randall Show.
Sure.
And for us, that was like finally breaking down the palace wall to get an assignment at MTM. And we made the mistake of bringing a cassette recorder and we recorded the story conference with everybody pitching all the jokes and everything as we're putting it together. And here's the problem with that. We then came home and like you said, there's like all of these jokes being pitched and we're now going, which ones are we obligated to use?
Right, right.
You know,
right.
This one doesn't really fit. Are they going to be mad? I mean, this was, you know, Gary Goldberg pitched this joke. Is he going to be pissed that it's not in the outline? And eventually we had to just stop recording these things. It's like whatever jokes we thought were funny were the jokes we wrote down and the others we just forgot. But we also they pitched out the story to us, and we did the first scene, which happens in the office, and then there's the second scene that happens at home. And basically what happens in the second scene is that Tony Randall comes back and tells all of the family members what happened in the first scene. Nothing moves the story forward. It's just a recap for the people who weren't there.
Yeah. There's $20 million worth of TV writing in that room, and they sent the two young writers out with a booby trap, basically. Right. They had no idea. They're just like, you know, that scene, we check in. We just check in with the other characters around the bar and find out what they think about what's going on. I'm like, okay, that scene, that C scene, okay. Yeah. Everybody chimes in. Yeah.
So we go, well, what? We can't do that. So what if we withhold this information, we add this, and we change this a little bit, and blah, blah, blah. So we do the two scenes, and we come in for, again, for our second draft notes. And they were very pleased with the script, but they had some problems with the first couple of scenes. And one of the showrunners was going, well, what is this where you pitch this and then this happened? I don't remember talking about any of that. And I said, well, yeah, we did that because what happens in the A scene, in the B scene, it's just a recap of it and nothing really moves the story forward. And the showrunner goes, oh, fuck, we're going to be here till midnight if we have to worry about shit like that. So we went back to exactly what they wanted, and we did the second draft, and they hired us on staff. They were so happy.
Who was it? Was it Jerry Belson who said his autobiography was going to be entitled "I Did It Their Way"?
Yeah, exactly.
I sort of sympathize with all the characters in that little drama you just pitched, because part of it is like, I've been that guy where you pitch something and you're like, that's fine. And then the writer comes back and they got little problems. Like, it's fine. I know what I'm doing. And then they do it. And then, you know, later, this is actually the biggest challenge we have, I think, in this business is evaluating the material in front of you without thinking about what it means about who's smarter and who's not, like your ego. And then I think I've been in the position where I've absolutely adamantly said, this is funny. This is going to work. Let's do this. And then you see it the first day and it's killer. You know, you got it. Like, I'm pretty smart. And then the second and third day you watch it fall apart because it actually doesn't make any sense. And the original objection that I steamrolled over, it turned out to be right. And then if you're a gracious person and smart and you like a good leader, you say, see, boy, you were right. I was wrong. We can fix this. If you're less than that, you get mad at everybody and go in your office and slam the door.
Yeah, I remember one time the first year of Cheers when Glenn Charles pitched a joke. We all laughed. It was a good joke. And he said, this could be the best joke of the year. Okay, so then we go down for the run through the next day and the joke bombs. And we come back to the room. Right. And Glenn goes, Jesus Christ, what a piece of shit. Let's get rid of this. It's like he was the one who wanted to get rid of it. But you do have to be objective, you know?
Yeah.
And that's the thing that actors need to learn when you're the showrunner and you're doing different episodes week after week that – every so often, you're going to get one that is problematic and the cast is going to freak and panic. Yeah, right. And you want to say to them, look, we were the same geniuses you loved last week and the week before. Okay. Right. So yes, it doesn't work. Take a deep breath. We'll go back and fix it.
But, and I always feel to me like that the fixing it is the skill. That's the skill. The skill isn't like some kind of weird magical talent where you can sit down and, you know, bang out a script that's great. I mean, no one can really do that. You have to fixing it is where the art comes in, I think. I mean, you ever see that terrible movie? It may not be Something's Gotta Give, but it's like in that, you know, pantheon when Diane Keaton's a playwright or something. And there's this shot of her. She's been blocked. And then she finally she gets it, and she know, and she's on a roll, and they just show her it at her computer, and she's just banging the keys like crazy and laughing at her writing, and she's not really looking at the screen at all, but she's laughing and laughing, and she's banging, she's playing the piano, they're playing the keyboard like a dog, like just pause, just it didn't look like she was typing any words, but she was really enjoying it. And that's the idea that people have for like, okay, that's a person, that's a writer on a roll, but that isn't it at all. You're like, I don't know, this is I'm gonna check an email. You want a Diet Coke? I'm gonna get, you know, like you do all that like stuff, and then the fixing it is where. But in order to fix it, you have to see it. That's what I would say to actors when they're like, "Well, we don't think be seen works when you walk into the stage to see it." And I say, "Okay, it's like a mechanic. You take your car in; the car's making a noise. The mechanic's got to hear the noise. You know how crazy it is when you go in and you say the mechanic is making a noise, and you start the car, it doesn't make the noise. Well, let me see it. Let me see it and see how terrible it is, and then we can fix it. But I think there's this fear people have that you're not going to fix it, or." The other fear, which I think people have in their lives, is what if I'm wrong and it's actually really great?
Uh-huh.
And then what if I do it, if I really do it 100%, it turns out it's really good. And then you're not going to change it, and I'm going to have said that it's no good. So it's like half the time, it's just really weird stakes that we put in the ground for our stupid ego. When in fact, I mean, I remember when I realized as a showrunner, when during the notes after every moment of your day, somebody calls you to give you notes, I didn't have to have a solution. I was like late in my career where I thought, oh, I don't have to know what the answer is.
Right.
That seemed a little weird. Yeah.
Look into that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I did this showrunner training thing at the WGA a couple times. And one time I got this question from somebody who I'm sure at this point has gone on to a very troubled career. And her question was, well, you know, first of all, she wanted to know why she couldn't share credit with every writer because she helps break the story. So shouldn't she get story credit? Just, and okay, that's not cool, lady. And then the second thing was when the executives ask after a rewrite has come in and it's really good, and after the show is on and people are really liking it, and sometimes an executive will say, oh, that was really great, that was really great, and they'll turn to the writer on the title page and they'll say, great script, great job. And it made her angry as the showrunner. She's like, that should come to me because I'm the one who did all the work. And there's about five showrunners there on the panel, and we're all kind of looking at each other like, you're lady, you are in for a very rocky time of it. This is your attitude. Because what I said to her was, you're going to get credit anyway. Like the best thing to do is to turn and say, look at this brilliant staff person I hired, and I'm the mentor too. And you could probably leave at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and the rest of your people will be so loyal. They'll do all the work. You don't have to have the solution. You've put a staff together to have a solution. You don't even have to be the best writer on the staff. You probably shouldn't be. And I feel like that's the hardest thing for the younger sort of new sort of showrunners to sort of understand, is that it isn't really, that's not really what's going to happen here. You're going to get credit for running a great show, not for writing a great script.
I want to go back to something you said, talking about the value of writers getting to do a second draft. And in some cases now, writers don't even get a chance to do a first draft. That shows are room written, where everybody sits around the conference table and everybody pitches and rewrites, actually writes from the beginning, a first draft. But it is so valuable as a writer. Like you said, not only are you improving your skills, but your problem solving and you're learning how to build stories and you're learning to differentiate different pitches. It's so valuable for a young writer to be writing a script. And nowadays, like I said, it's not even so much a second draft. Young writers don't get to do a first draft. And I was directing on a show that worked that way. And I was talking to one of the young writers, and he said, I've been on this show now for 2 years. I'm afraid to sit down and write a script by myself now. It's been so long that I've lost confidence that I can sit in a room and just do it myself.
Well, I actually, okay, I have a larger larger theory about this that's probably you may not agree with, but and I'm sure people will hate it. How's that for a preamble? I'm about to say something everybody's going to hate. I think that you can do that when the show doesn't have to be funny. When these comedies that aren't funny, that are kind of quirky and story driven, not that it's bad, but like very plot heavy, and there's no spontaneity to it. I mean, the thing about Cheers was it was super spontaneous. We did it in front of an audience. It was a play.
That's right.
It had a kind of electricity to it that even the great single camera shows don't have because they're shot like a movie. And if you're shooting everything like a little movie and it's a little like little jewel box that you're making, I guess you can probably break the staff up into five teams and everybody writes a scene and then you come back in the afternoon and you stitch the scenes together and you're telling a story that like, okay, it's got a beginning, middle and end, and it's got a little, but it doesn't seem like it ever catches fire. You know, there are moments the really great Cheers episodes where like this second act is just kind of bananas because everything has caught fire, and that's the kind of energy you get when you go and sit at a run through with really great actors and a really good script and you see, oh shit, this is really funny. And I think that's why people watch those shows over and over again, because they seem kind of electric, and whereas some of the other ones just seem kind of like, I don't know. There's no energy. And so like if you're writing it, room writing, I don't know. Room writing maybe can work, I suppose. It gives me a headache, but I guess people can do it. But it doesn't seem to have the kind of joyful spontaneity that I like when I watch TV, you know?
Right.
So I don't know, maybe it's just a taste thing or a personal choice thing, but.
I think people would be surprised to know when we all sit in a writer's room, I'm sure people imagine somebody pitches a joke, everybody laughs, and that happens.
Yeah, that happens. Yeah.
But more often than not, someone will pitch a joke and people will nod and go, okay, that's funny. Okay, good. We'll do that. Yeah. Do that. And the audience will laugh. But
yeah,
we comedy writers don't laugh. Except when we go down to the stage for the run through, when we have to laugh for the actors. The actors, you know, get the feedback like, oh, okay, this is working. They like
this is where the laugh will be. Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and sometimes you catch yourself at a run through really laughing and you're like, wow, no, I was really, no, this time I wasn't bullshitting. This was a real laugh. Tom Leopold, who is one of the funniest people ever to walk the earth, used to do this great imitation of the writing staff laughter at the run through, which was like, I really need this job. I just really need the money for this. Like the desperate laughter, like which actually was great, which, you know, kind of you could kind of sometimes hear that hysteria, like I have to leave here by 8 p.m. like in the laughter. But I feel like in the room when writers say, I've done this, like, oh, that's funny. Oh, that's funny. Or that's a funny attitude. Yeah, let's that's funny attitude. That's really kind of it's like, I don't take too much time to laugh because I feel like we got something. And the other lesson you learn or you have to teach a lot, I don't think I know how to learn it. I think it was just something that was in the air at Cheers you would never do. Is not to start joking on the joke. Like, so people editorialize you say a line like, and that's why the balloon popped. And they go, yeah, that's why that purple balloon exploded. No, but what did Staley, my partner, writing partner, Dan Staley, was always really like, wait, stop. Everyone stop talking. What was the first thing you said? Well, that's when the balloon popped. Okay, that's the line. That's what we all laughed
exactly.
at.
Exactly.
That's when the purple balloon exploded in her face. No. That's just, and that's a hard thing to do.
That's what we do too. If somebody pitches a line and it does get a laugh from the room, you go, it goes in that way. And somebody will say, yeah, but it kind of doesn't make sense. And wouldn't it be better if the punchline was at the very end? And you go, however he pitched it, made us all laugh. That is the line.
I don't know if you were there because it was not, you guys did Mondays, but there was a Thursday rewrite on Cheers. And that was Bob Ellison's day. another just incredibly funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
And Ellison,
former guest on this podcast.
Oh, wow, that's good.
Yeah.
Ellison pitched something. It wasn't really much of it. It wasn't for some reason. You know, everybody has this moment. Like, we had a story. The script was good. The story was funny. Everything was fine. It needed to be punched up. It wasn't as funny as it should be. And there were a couple more turns that we needed. It wasn't as interesting as it should be, but it's going to get there. It was Wednesday, the first day. And then we had a run through, and Thursday it was pretty close, but the last parts weren't that, it needed some help. Normal situation, really, with the script. And Ellison pitched something that was really, really funny. And, Jimmy Burrows, who was our director and impresario and, you know, basically the godfather of the show, and had really unerring instincts. Like, he really does know where the funny part of the thing is. He can just, it's like a bloodhound, you know. But for some reason, he didn't like it. He wanted something different. And we kept pitching the kind of better versions of what we had. And then Ellison pitched this incredibly funny thing. And then Jimmy made the mistake of saying, yeah, but that's just a comic turn. And Ellison's look on Ellison's face was like, and then he did the screen, went, oh, I'm so sorry. Oh, I apologize. Which is not really an Ellison, he's a genial guy, but like you could just tell he was super pissed. Forgive me. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't realize I shouldn't be pitching comic turns. And he was sort of, at that point, he was sort of channeling David Lloyd. And Jimmy kind of looked at him and eyes, he goes, well, I don't know. It's funny. I mean, we should try it. Yeah. Oh, no. We don't want to do too many comic turns in our Cheers comedy show. And he wouldn't let it go. So finally, Jimmy sort of slunk out of the room. And I don't remember how that story ends. I don't remember how whether we used it or we didn't use it. But I remember the absolute outrage on a writer's face when told that he was guilty of pitching something funny.
Yeah. It always pisses me off if I get the note from a network that'll say, well, yeah, this is funny, but, mm-hmm. And you want to stop them and say, whoa, do you think it's easy to make something funny? You know? Sure, it's funny. Oh, sure, you hit a home run, but your home run trot was really slow.
Yeah. I kind of feel like the solution to the problem for them is funny. Like, it's like a Freudian thing where I've been reading all this stuff now, so I think it's Jungian, where you identify the thing that saves you and you describe it as an enemy. So you say, that's funny, but I don't know. Like, I'm not sure about funny. Well, that in Jungian analysis, which all these executives should go through, you should be identifying that as, okay, that's my shadow. What's that telling me that I don't like this thing? Maybe that's the answer. And if they put on funny shows, then maybe they get more 15 shares. Like, that, maybe that's the solution. It's like you have this gigantic addressable market. Nobody says, I don't care. I am only going to watch shows on certain channels on certain streaming services. No, they'll watch whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Put on something funny and it's Big Bang Theory. Put on something not funny and it's, I keep shitting on this show. I shouldn't. It's the Mindy Project, you know?
No one hates the Mindy Project more than me. That's okay.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's a perfectly respectable show, right? It wasn't evil or bad or anything. It just wasn't funny.
Two Broke Girls is another one I hated too.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But in any case, I remember Fief Sutton told me this once. He said it was like a really bad meeting. It was just the wrong day for him to go in for a meeting. He was like tired and something had happened. And I think he had just sold one of his mystery novels. And he was like, what am I doing this shit for? And he goes in and so whoever the executive is says something like, you know, we're just not having any success with multicam comedies. And he just says, well, how many do you have on right now? We don't have any on. He said, well, do you think maybe that's why they're not successful? You don't have any on. So, they're not going to be successful unless you have them on. I mean, no one can watch a show that's not on the air. No, that's not what we mean. We just mean, I said, I think I know what you mean. You're just not putting them on. You don't want to put them on. You don't have to come. And he wouldn't let it go. And I think that was, you know, he didn't make any friends in the meeting, but I was sort of cheering him along the way you do when writers stand up for something and you're like, I would not, I would so cave. I would, oh, you're right. They're horrible. I would not stand. But I'm glad somebody did. Somebody yeah. with a book deal.
Of course, he's now writing for the Hallmark Channel.
Right, right.
They yeah. give well, lots of notes.
Yeah, that's right. Can there be no conflict?
Exactly. We talked about David Lloyd, who was a brilliant comedy mm-hmm. writer. Sadly, he's no longer with us. But among the many great episodes of television that he wrote was Chuckles Bites the Dust, the yeah. iconic episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show. But he was really acerbic, and yeah. he would write a script, and normally somebody writes a script, you turn it in, and then the staff has at it and fixes whatever the showrunner feels needs to be fixed, and you all understand that's part of the game. It's like you don't get defensive because it's not going to work and you're not going to save your stuff anyway. And so you just hope that when you turn in a script that 80% or 85% yeah. is going to be you, and the other 15% is going to be better than what you had, and you're able to take the credit for it. So if they would change a David Lloyd script,
oh yeah,
and we would have the table reading and the stuff that we had changed didn't work.
I remember that.
We'd come back to the room and, oh my God, he would just beat the crap out of us. Like, oh, this was funny. This was much better. Much better. Yeah. Remember those days?
I think that one joke was we came back from the table reading. It was always Wednesdays. And for some reason, Wednesdays, we'd have that deli spread from Victor's. Mm-hmm. And that was so there's a local deli, and they put all the stuff out there. And someone said, I think the egg salad smells funny. And David said, does it smell as funny as that table reading? And then that was kind of, he would never come right out and say, okay, every joke you pitched bombed. But we just knew that he knew it. He knew that we knew that he knew it. He knew that we were waiting for him to say something. He knew, and we knew that he knew. So everything, he didn't have to do that much. Merely just a setup was enough to convey his attitude. But he also kind of like, I mean, I always thought that was sort of strange about him, because at that point in his career, he was so successful. He was so great. And he had so much authority that, like, he didn't just say, yeah, I tried something there. I swung for the fence a little bit, and that was a little bit weird. Sorry about that. Instead, he would like dig in. I remember one script he had, and he had like you know how in parades or something, or doggy parades, that dogs will walk on their hind legs. These poodles walk on their hind legs with little hats on,
uh-huh.
and little. He had that. That I think it was a scene blow or something. That was the joke at the end of a scene. And we're like, David, what are you? How is that? Like, you can't. And instead of saying, "Hey, I'm David Lloyd. I'm trying something. I thought it might be funny." Instead, he's like, he got really mad. Like, that is like, maybe I just don't have the work ethic that David Lloyd had. But I kept thinking, like, man, you're David Lloyd. You can just say, I would like to see it. I will come back on Thursday when we have the poodles. And I'm telling you, if you show me the poodles, I bet you it's funny. Instead, he was just sort of mad. So that was I think that's the other side of that kind of attitude you get. Half the time, I think he was totally right, and what he'd written was perfect, and we just changed it for just stupid reasons. And the other half, I think he thought he was digging in for no reason. And that's actually the struggle we always have, like as writers, right? Am I digging in because I'm mad about the fact that it doesn't work, or am I digging in because I know it's going to work? I mean, you know. You and I have had these experiences where we throw stuff out, and we're convinced to throw it out, and we're like, we should not have thrown that out. Should not have, you know, but... You never know until you're done, until you're canceled.
Yeah.
And then everything is revealed.
Yeah. The very first Tony Randall show that we did, we're walking to the stage with the showrunners, and by now we're on staff. And the showrunner says, you know, guys, I think we screwed up your last scene. I think what you had is actually better than mm-hmm. what we're going to do. And of course, I just, you know, I'm the baby writer. So I just like, okay. But what I wanted to say is, then go back to the original. Right. Then what are you shooting something that you know is right. not as good?
Right.
Okay, there's part one. I can hear you going, no, no, more. I want more. Well, next week is just as fascinating. My part two interview with Rob Long. Hey, I want to thank Adam and Susie Meister, Butler, Howard Hoffman, John Wolford, Bruce and Jason Miller. I am available if you want to reach me via email, HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That is HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine. I noticed after the vice presidential debate, the fly that landed on Mike Pence's head, within several hours, it got 50,000 followers. So come on, I got to be at least as good as a fly. I'm also on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Part two coming up next week with Rob Long. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Stay safe. Hollywood and Levine.